Hello, and welcome to Academy Conversations Uncut, a podcast of rare Q&As with the world's foremost filmmakers, hosted by the Academy and released for the first time to the public, unedited. Today's panel was recorded in December 2015 at the Samuel Goldwyn Theater in Beverly Hills, California, discussing the Academy Award-winning movie, The Hateful Eight, Quentin Tarantino's ultra-violent Western set in the aftermath of the Civil War. We were joined by costume designer Courtney Hoffman, editor Fred Raskin, producer Richard N. Gladstein, actors Jennifer Jason Leigh, Kurt Russell, and Samuel L. Jackson, and writer and director Quentin Tarantino. The panel was hosted by John Horn. Here's John.
Thank you guys for sticking around. My name's John Horn. I'm the host of The Frame. The Academy has asked me to tell you all, please do not take photos or shoot videos during the Q&A. So thank you. Let's bring up our filmmakers, costume designer Courtney Hoffman. Editor Fred Raskin. Producer Richard Gladstein. Actor Jennifer Jason Leigh. And to her immediate left, actor Kurt Russell. Actor Samuel L. Jackson. Writer-director Quentin Tarantino. Richard, I'm gonna start with you. You produced a whole lot of movies. I would imagine that producing a Quentin Tarantino movie is a little bit different because he probably kind of knows where he's going. He knows how to get there, and your job is a little bit different. How would you describe the difference in producing a Quentin Tarantino movie versus producing most other filmmakers?
Let's see. I would say that, you know, as you're beginning to make any film, you sit down and talk to the director about what he or she wants to do. With Quentin, that first couple meetings have a greater importance because he's essentially going to outline to me how we're going to produce the movie and how we're going to make the movie and why he wants to do everything that he wants to do. And as a producer, your job is, as it always is with all directors, is to support them. But with Quentin, he has an instinctual way that he wants to make the movie. And our job is to just find ways in which to support and hopefully enhance that vision and do the wacky things that he would like to do because they're really good ideas.
Like, I'm going to shoot on location in Colorado, and then we're going to move to a soundstage. Things like that.
Well, starting in Colorado is not that wacky. The idea of building minis inside and outside in Colorado and shooting almost the entire movie on the side of a mountain as opposed to on a soundstage is not wacky, but different.
Quentin, I want to talk to you a little bit about the things you were thinking about when you were writing this story. There's been a lot of great Westerns on television that have had kind of a hostage story. There's a lot of Agatha Christie in this story, and it also feels like you're taking a lot of the guest stars or guest characters from every Western and throwing them in the same room.
Yeah.
Are you thinking about character first? You think about story? How do these people, how do the eight come together in your mind?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess the jumping off point, the part that, whenever I'm asked a question like that, I try to not get too lost in what happened later, but literally, what was it that made me sit down at the table in the first place and face a bunch of blank paper and take a pen and start writing? And I think the idea was, as opposed to most other movies, I was actually kind of influenced by a lot of Western TV shows that I've been watching in the last 5 years, like, the Bonanza and Virginian in particular, but Big Valley and Gunsmoke, stuff like that. And one of the things that influenced me that led me to this was I in particular watched the episodes that had really cool guest stars in them, like William Shatner or Robert Culp or James Coburn or Vic Morrow, people like that. And one of the things that I noticed is when I watched those episodes, if Robert Culp was the guest star of The Virginian, the episode was about him. It wasn't about Doug McClure. It wasn't about James Drury. He had something going on, and the story was about that. And in almost every one of those situations, they were a stranger coming into the situation. Other people didn't know them that well. And you didn't know that much about them, but then they had a past that was revealed at some point. You never knew how true that past was or how not true it was. And you also didn't know if they were a good guy or a bad guy for most of the episode. You had to watch the entire episode to find out, are they the protagonist or are they antagonist? Is Doug McClure going to end up being his friend at the end and the show ends as a friend, or does Doug McClure end up killing him at the end? And that literally is the show's. And I thought about, well, what if I took about 8 of those guys and then trap them in the room, and there is no Doug McClure. There is no Michael Landon as Little Joe in there. There is no moral center. There is no guy that you know who's a good guy, who you know who he is, that you can gravitate towards. And then the whole, you know, they trap him in a room, put a blizzard outside that's almost like a monster in a monster movie waiting to devour them if they ever step outside, and then have them, we'd find out who they were through the hashing it out, but you couldn't trust anything anybody said. And then from that point on, it was the idea of introducing the mystery element, which I'd never done before, that what I was looking forward to.
And is there a way to meld that idea with the way in which you shot this film in a format that hasn't been used in 50 years? What does that format give you as a storyteller that the story itself is suggesting?
Well, you know, the thing about it is, you know, we had done a script reading of the piece that went really well, and that script reading and most of the actors, all the actors that are, most of the actors that are here were in that script reading. And I have to say, I think we walked away from that script reading with a lot of confidence about the material. And I finished a couple of the drafts, and then we rehearsed it for a while, and we had a lot of confidence. And I felt that, I just think I had a lot of confidence in the material. So I felt that if we did it at a 99-seat theater off of Santa Monica Boulevard, it would be really good. And if we did it on the London stage, it would be really good. So let's do it in 70mm and make it really, really good. Because I felt it would make an event. It would make it very, very cinematic. I could really shoot the weather in a way that it would literally be another character, in a way that I wouldn't be able to do on stage, per se. Also, if I shoot it in 70mm, well, that's kind of expensive, so the studio is gonna make an attempt to actually get it shown in 70mm, at least to some degree or another, and so I wouldn't just be relying completely on digital projection, which I've worked a little too long to just have diminishing results. And so, you know, that was kind of where I was coming from on it.
And does it?
Oh, no, but also, there was one other aspect in particular, was the fact that, there was some speculation about, well, why is he shooting it on 70mm if most of it just takes place in a big old shack? And I don't think 70mm was created just to shoot the seven wonders of the world and mountain ranges. I actually think that there's an intimacy to big scope formats like that if you use it the correct way. I have shot a lot of close-ups of this man right here. But I have never shot close-ups the way they look in this movie with him. And I also kind of felt, frankly, and I'll shut up after this, I also kind of felt that by shooting in 70mm, the way that both IMAX or 3D can put you in the room, this would put you in the room. It would put you inside of Minnie's haberdashery, as opposed to looking back at Minnie's haberdashery. But not the way 3D does, and not the way IMAX does, but in its own way, and to me, a more meaningful way.
For the actors, thank you. For the actors, is there any different way in performance when you're shooting this format in terms of what's in the frame, that you are in the background, you're in the foreground, that it's seen everything, there's no place to hide, in other words?
Well, we already decided this was a really intimate ensemble piece after we did the rehearsal and the reading. And when we started to rehearse in the studio here in L.A., they built minis for us to rehearse for like 2.5-3 weeks. And as we moved around that room, we realized what our relationships were with each other, who wanted to be close to who, wanted to be close to who, where the heat sources were, how we wanted to use them, and the scope of that lens. We were told what it was. So we realized we were doing a play. So even if they're shooting on that side of the room, you can see what's going on over here. So we needed to have lives. So we found our business. We found the things we needed to do while the other actors were working. We found places where the other actors could look over their shoulders and see if we were looking or paying attention to what they were doing or not paying attention. So it became a very intimate exercise between all of us and making sure we were supporting the other actors on the other side of the room, no matter what was going on.
I want to ask about this shot of Daisy. It's how long a shot? 5-minute shot of Daisy?
Oh, what, you mean the one she plays the guitar?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're around that, four or five minutes, something like that, yeah.
Editorially, is that, I mean, is that, was that the design from the beginning, that you, this would be one shot? And how did you cut that, I guess, or how did you not cut it together?
How did you cut it together? Well, one of the Fred's more easier shots, frankly.
But was that part, was that something the format gave you, that kind of intimacy in a scene like that, or was it always the design to go long?
Always the design. I mean,
there's a lot. There's a lot of coverage. We
there
shot.
There was
coverage,
a lot of coverage.
Yeah.
However, I mean, when we saw it in 70, you don't want to cut away. Like, there's no. Look at how beautiful the image is and how much detail you can see in every aspect of the frame. But of course, we did get the opportunity to use some of the coverage in the multiplex version of the movie. Because, you know, it's not in 70, it's digital. So you'll be able to see some of that.
I mean, there's a different editorial cut of that scene.
Yeah, the DCP has a few different little moments that just are a little different, all right? Because it's like, well, it's not 70. It's not La Boheme at La Scala. It's you're going to the Tarzana 9, all right, to watch it. And... maybe everybody isn't so precious about the whole damn thing.
just to sort of clarify, so the version that you all saw, the 70 millimeter with the overture and the intermission, is our movie. That's what we're presenting for 2 weeks plus exclusively in 98 theaters throughout North America. The same thing will be replicated in Europe and Asia, et cetera, later. And that's what how we're starting, 2 weeks plus, and then on January 8th, everywhere, is our multiplex version, which doesn't have the intermission, the overture, and about 5 minutes taken out. That's the deal between the two versions.
Courtney, outside of the four characters that we see earlier in the story, you basically, with your costume design, have one shot. I mean, you're basically the field goal kicker who's got a 50-yarder at the as time is running out. When you're talking to Quentin about the designs and how iconic and how revealing and how complicated they have to be, you have basically one shot. What were the conversations that you had with Quentin about whether or not you were going to fit the character, whether or not there's going to be a little deception in how you were costuming? What were the kinds of conversations you had?
Yeah, I mean, if you start with the script, Quentin has such a wealth of character information. So you kind of start there. But from that, you know, we really had these Western archetypes all in one room. So you have the sheriff and the bounty hunter and the cowboy. And so really fleshing out those archetypes to both fit and deceive their characters and each other was something that was really fun to do. We worked with a lot of film references, obviously. And I also worked with the Autry Museum, and we were able to use some of their pieces from the 1800s that we were able to look at. And like John Ruth's coat is a coat straight from the Autry. And it was like, he's a bully. So I wanted him to be a bully on screen, to take over that space. And, you know, Sam's costume is kind of like the Lincoln Letter. It's disarming. It's debonair. It's Lee Van Cleef. So I think that was sort of where we started. And obviously having such great actors to work with is always a dream.
I want to hear from the actors about the fittings and about wearing Courtney's wardrobe the first time. I mean, could you talk a little bit about how that helped in terms of character and what her designs gave you? Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how much Courtney was telling about Daisy and how much it informed me, actually. Actually, when I first went to meet on the movie, it was in Quentin's guest house. And there were her boards were every character had a board, and on the board were drawings of the characters and pictures from the period and fabrics and furs, and I just was so inspired. It was just such a cool room to walk into and see all of this inspiring, beautiful research and the drawings, and then to see the costumes, the details, like my gloves. You know, there's a... I could feel the week she had had with John Ruth by putting on the clothes. There's a hole in one of the fingers on the glove. The gloves are hand embroidered. Everything she did, whether you saw it or not, all
there's
the
a lot
clothes,
you didn't see. You'd be surprised how much you couldn't see.
But it didn't matter to Courtney. Like, everything, whether you saw it or not, was going to be absolutely perfect and so beautiful and so real. And it weighed a ton. And it kept us warm.
It was warm, yeah. It was warm.
And that was her aim, was to keep us warm, but to be completely authentic down to, like, literally the soles of our shoes. And, yeah, I was kind of blown away. Like, all those flowers on my dress that you never saw are so beautiful.
Each of them was embroidered.
Yeah, each one was embroidered. So,
Quentin, the two actors you're right, you've worked with before. Can you talk a little bit about casting Jennifer on this part?
Well, you know, it's you know, it's interesting because I wrote for Sam, I wrote for Kurt, and they're gonna take it to some wonderful places. But I have a really good idea where they're going with it because I have a good idea about the character and I have a good idea about them as actors. And I did that for a lot of the actors in the movie. So, consequently, having said that, you start kind of falling in love with the one character that you're not writing for an actor because that character just kind of goes wherever it goes. And then you write the whole story and then that's where it goes. And now I have to find somebody to do it. But, you know, the way Daisy was written, you know, there's a whole lot, you know, I could read any of the guys and they have a lot of dialogue to say. And Daisy actually doesn't have a lot of dialogue until it gets to the end. And you can't really ask an actress to come in and deliver, like, say, her big monologue that she gives at the end in an office. And, oh, wow, that's it. Because you have to have almost done the entire movie and played that whole role to get to that spot. So I brought Jennifer in. We had a lot of fun, and she did a really intriguing work in it that I actually thought, oh, this could be good. She could be really interesting in that. And it was really, really intriguing. But frankly, it was more about going back and having my own Jennifer Jason Leigh film festival. And so I rewatched a shitload of movies of hers that I'd seen before, and I watched a bunch that I hadn't seen, and I watched about like 8 or 9 movies that she did pretty much in about like a week period. And I've always been a big fan of hers, and it just doubly enamored me of her. And it made me realize just what a fantastic actress she is. And, you know, everybody in Hollywood in the 90s felt that Jennifer Jason Leigh was the female Sean Penn. And if I have this rogues gallery of men, right, that I have to deal with, I need a female Sean Penn, all right, to put in this thing. And so I did, but we did have actually, she almost says it better than I do. We had a nice discussion, and I go, look, we're going to put this together, but you have to build Daisy. You have to live Daisy day by day by day. So let's just do it together. Let's go on this journey together, and let's not be result oriented. Let's not figure out about effects and how we're going to solve them. Let's just be Daisy every day. Let everything happen to you, and let's just build from there. She can probably describe it even better than I do, but that was the idea, setting it off.
Yeah, but as trippy as that was, though, because we watched her throughout rehearsal, and, I mean, we're all, you know, Quentin veterans, so we do what we do, and Jennifer was kind of, she was walking on eggshells a little bit, you know, but she's with this one, who's, like, constantly going, come on, and at a certain point, it's like, things change in a very interesting way. So until we got in those clothes and we started to shoot that first day and we're in the snow out there and I'm walking up on that stagecoach with my hands up, Jennifer had been kind of quiet and tame all that time. And I knew she was there with Kurt. And then she sticks her head out the window and says, you know, howdy, nigga. And blows his She'd never done that before. And I'm like, well, Quentin doesn't let us improvise. What the fuck's going on? But then I realized, oh shit, that's Daisy. She got a black eye? Because I'd never seen all that stuff. And she's got a costume on, and everything changes when you get dressed and you're out there in it. And she blew that snot out of her nose, and then she started gnawing on the stagecoach window. And I was standing there like, what the fuck is that? Jennifer's lost her mind. And then I realized, oh shit, this is the Daisy we've been waiting to see. And then I get in the stagecoach, and Kurt elbows her in the face, and she's sitting there looking at me, and I'm staring at her, and we'd rehearsed this, and all of a sudden she winked at me. And I went, what the fuck just happened? And Quentin's right behind me. Quentin's going, did she wink at you?
He goes, yeah, motherfucker, she just winked.
She winked at me.
Can you believe that
you
shit?
Believe this shit? And that's when we knew, okay, we got Daisy in the stagecoach, and she's crazy, and she's feral. And then we knew she was going to be fine from that point on.
Kurt, I want to ask you, when you get the script and you see what Quentin has written for you, do you find that he is writing in your voice as an actor? And if he isn't, are you having conversations with Quentin about what you think you should say and what your character is? How much back and forth is there between you and Quentin about dialogue and about character?
I don't know. We never really talked about that. I just got a phone call from Quentin. He said, I'm going to do this reading. You know, would you do the reading? I said, hey, that'd be fun. And I didn't realize it was a screenplay that had been leaked and had angered him. And then I learned later on that this was that screenplay, and then that I understood why he was angry, because he was only partially finished with it. He wasn't really anywhere near done with it. And, you know, we started talking about that, and the next thing I knew, we were going to rehearse it. And I thought, oh, I guess he wants to get this in shape to show somebody. And the next thing I knew, we were going to put this in front of 1,600 people at a theater. And I thought, well, I guess he wants to see this thing. So we ended up doing it. And in the process of that, one day when we were doing Death Proof, I was in the middle of a scene, and I was talking to one of the actresses. I was playing the part, doing the role, saying the words. And I just got into one of these takes where I was boring myself to death. And I was boring myself so much, I just started doing it like John Wayne, to get going with something. And he didn't stop me. Most other guys would have said, whoa, cut, what are we doing here? You know. But he didn't do that. He went, okay, now go back, go halfway back, and go back and do it all like John Wayne. And then I did that, and he said, now stop and go here. And I thought, oh, this is so great. And I was alive again and happening and having a great time. And it actually made sense for some of what you'd written earlier. And then when we started this, I kind of looked at him, and he was like looking at me like, yeah, go there. Mm-hmm. So for the reading, I did. Then for coming back to do the movie, I didn't want to do that. But I didn't want to, not do what Quentin didn't want to do. So it was like I didn't really talk about it, but we just sort of started there. And it was kind of interesting for me, because I just sort of did it until I figured he's going to change pretty soon here. And sure enough, one day he said, okay, that's good. Now let's start losing that and go somewhere else. So it was also a process with Quentin of trying to find something. I got about six names on the part of the script that I have that, some of it's Jackie Gleason, some of it's Roderick Crawford, some of Jason Robards, guys that in certain kinds of ways, in certain kinds of movies, reminded me of a place that it's okay to go to in creating a character. And I just thought it was wonderful to have the opportunity to, try to pile up another character that'd be fun to do.
Quentin, this is obviously, like a lot of your movies, a period film. And I'm curious, especially in the genre of the Western, what does that give you as a storyteller to tell a story that's relevant today in the context of a period film? And since we know this script was written and leaked more than a year ago, does it help that you were writing about things then that have kind of eclipsed us in the real world? And was that part of your intention at that time? And did you have conversations with your actors about what those intentions were?
Well, it wasn't part of my intention in the writing of it. However, when all of a sudden certain things started certain connections started happening, or especially in the theatrical piece, when you're not writing, you're not writing a normal script. So it's all about, you know, where it's all about the storytelling and the characters that come in and come out and all the different locations. When you're doing a more theatrical piece where everyone's in one room and really all the writing is involved in kind of plumbing the depths of their characters that they express through dialogue, some interesting things can come out if you're not just thinking about storytelling all the time. And one of the things that, you know, so that ended up happening. However, I actually do think that one of the things that actually is very interesting about Westerns is Westerns end up telling you a whole lot, more than probably any other genre or subgenre, end up telling you a whole lot about the decades in which they were made. While out trying to comment on them, they end up commenting on them, especially when you're talking about the way the Westerns talk about America at the time. And what I mean by that is probably the time when Westerns were at their most popular were the 50s, and those Westerns really told the story of the Eisenhower America and told the story of a perceived American exceptionalism that was born out of winning World War II and the birth of the suburbs and prosperity for all, at least the idea of prosperity for all, or the myth of prosperity for all. And going into the late 60s, into the 70s, one of my favorite periods of Westerns in America, those Westerns were cynical, and there was about cynicism and about disillusionment. And those Westerns dealt with, in their own way, with Vietnam. They dealt with campus unrest, and they dealt with Watergate. And you know, consequently, probably the most one of the biggest Westerns of the 80s, at least the one that the studios put the most punch in, was probably Silverado. And if that's not a Reagan Western, I don't know what is. And consequently, when I was writing this, I wasn't thinking about any of that shit. I was actually thinking about doing my little version of Iceman Cometh or Outcast of Poker Flat or something like that, and with a little Agatha Christie thrown in. But then all of a sudden, Major Warren and Chris Mannix have that almost political argument that they have in the Stagecoach. And, you know, I can't stand the Confederacy. I've always felt that it was the American equivalent of the Nazi Party, and the way people feel about the rebel flag now, I've always felt. However, I don't judge my characters, and as that argument happened, Chris Mannix made a pretty eloquent defense for the Confederacy, or at least even for the Quantrell version of the Confederacy afterwards. And I was like, I shocked myself that I actually came up with something that I couldn't poo-poo, all right, when it came to that side of the argument. And I go, holy shit, this is kind of a blue state, red state Western, all right? But I'm kind of playing fair in that regards. I'm not turning one person into a villain versus another person. Everyone kind of has their side. And that was the last thing in the world I expected. So, of course, it was one of my favorite things that I wrote because it almost didn't come from me. It came from the characters.
And Samuel, I mean, Major Warren feels like a modern character in many ways. Did you feel that while you're making the movie or just now that he's coming out?
I never felt he was modern. I just felt he was a survivor. And he understood how to survive. He lasted through some very interesting times. And I always think, you know, back on my life, and I say the same thing, that I was born in, at the end of the 40s, but I lived through the 50s in segregated Tennessee. I lived through the civil rights movement, had my moments in that, lived through the Vietnam era, lived through the 60s, I lived through the free love, drugs, and whole, you know, that, and I'm still here, and I'm doing all this stuff. And Warren went from slavery, a life of slavery, into a war, came out of a war, fought another war with the Indians, and then became a bounty hunter. But he's living in a time that's a very transitional time, where free black people are learning how to live, and free white people are trying to make sure they don't find a way to live. But he's managing, so he's a survivor, and he's a very smart survivor, and a man that can use his smarts and his guns can find a way to make it in that particular world. And I've used my smarts, and I haven't had to use my guns, but I'm okay.
They're going to lock the garages at 11:30. We could talk for another half hour, but we got to let you go. Quentin, Samuel, Kurt, Jennifer, Richard.
Thank you all.
Fred,
thank you,
Hartney.
Thank you.
Thank,
so thank
you. Thank you guys for sticking around. Thank you guys for coming out.
Thanks for listening to Academy Conversations Uncut. We hope you enjoyed this unique access to a members-only Q&A at the Academy. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe, and help us reach film lovers around the world. This podcast was produced by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.